You're listening to the Diplomats Asia Geopolitics Podcast. I'm Katie Putz, recording in Washington, D.C.
And this is Ankit Panda. I am still in the mountains in upstate New York, getting a little bit of time away.
So South Korean President Lee Jae-myung hit the road recently, making visits to Japan and the United States in that order. In this episode, Ankit and I are going to dive into the geopolitics of Lee's recent travels and the state of affairs between Korea, Japan, and the United States, which is a critical trilateral, occasionally knocked off course by issues both bilateral and domestic. I think a good place to start, Ankit, is maybe the question of why Lee traveled to Japan before going to the United States. My understanding is that usually it's the other way around, but I'm certainly interested in your take on what's the significance of that choice.
Yeah, it's pretty significant, I think. So, you know, just to provide a little bit of political context here, Japan-Korea relations have been good for the last couple of years, but before that, they were very, very bad. In fact, at one of their lowest points in decades, arguably. And that low point was under Lee Jae-myung's predecessor from the Democratic Party, Moon Jae-in. These are Korean presidents who come from the progressive side of Korean politics, where many of the difficult historical issues, the issue of wartime forced labor, the comfort women issue, a whole range of issues going back to Japan's occupation of Korea have very much been resonant emotionally with both politicians and their voters. There were a series of crises that took place for a variety of reasons. There was a radar lock-on. There was a court decision in Korea that wasn't anything that the presidential office could really maneuver on, just given the separation of powers. But all of these together plunged Korea-Japan relations into a fairly low point for a while, until there was a change of leadership. Yoon Suk-yeol, who's been removed from office after the martial law crisis, he was a conservative, very much more pragmatic, you could say, about building a closer relationship with Japan. And he was very much, encouraged in that endeavor by the Biden administration in the United States. So all of those figures we're talking about are no longer in office, right? We have a completely different constellation of leaders today. We have Trump in the White House. We have Prime Minister Ishiba, who was not the leader who came to Camp David. That was his predecessor, Kishida Fumio in Japan, and Lee Jae-myung in Korea. So why did he go to Japan? I think there's a big thing here that obviously is forcing both Korean progressives and the Japanese to get pragmatic about the relationships that they have immediately available to them in their neighborhood economically. All right. Both Korea and Japan are under siege by the Trump administration's policies on tariffs, for instance, and are facing similar dynamics in dealing with their ally, the United States. And in the meantime, they share a lot of the same concerns regionally about North Korea, Russia, China, etc. And so it's pretty remarkable that, Lee Jae-myung, despite being a progressive, can do this. I do think it's worth emphasizing, though, that he's sort of still in his honeymoon period, right? He was just elected into office, just started his term. His approval rating is still really good for a Korean president, right? It's not above 50 because that's extremely rare in Korea, but it's still in the low to mid 40s, which is good enough for him to take a risk like this, even if it gets him blowback. And the conservatives in Korea, really, this is not going to be the issue that they're going to rake Lee Jae-myung over the coals, because they are generally more supportive of a closer relationship with Japan. So that's the broader context. And then in terms of, what will get done in Korea-Japan relations, that's a broader question. But certainly, I think the main purpose of Lee Jae-myung doing this was to basically reciprocate Ishiba, Prime Minister Ishiba in Japan, who, his political future is still uncertain. Essentially reciprocating his interest in better Korea-Japan relations. So it'll very much be interesting to see if that momentum will persist, particularly if the United States continues to treat both allies with a degree of, what you might call it, a degree of, just concern. I mean, the U.S. is treating allies very poorly in that part of the world and elsewhere. So that's going to be, I think, an important driver. So sorry, that was a long answer, but I think the background is pretty important to appreciate why this mattered.
Yeah. And then another thread I kind of want to pull out from that is, there are sort of greater geopolitical forces and circumstances that are kind of pushing Japan and Korea back into a better place with each other, the sort of domestic politics on either side, aside. But as you mentioned, Japanese Prime Minister Shiba is not in the most comfortable of positions domestically. You never really know where South Korean politics is going to go either. So, you know, how important are these larger geopolitical forces, both the United States and sort of a change in tone and tempo and just engagement style under the Trump administration? And then China is sort of always looming over the geopolitics in Asia. And so how does that factor into this? I don't know if rapprochement is the right word, but that's the one that my brain came up with.
Yeah, no, I think it's all kind of part of it. I mean, you know, neither side is going to be able to move away from the United States, right? That's just not an option. Mm-hmm. And so really it's about not even hedging, but just, you know, being able to get things done with a partner that's facing very similar economic and political and geopolitical headwinds immediately in the region. I don't think we should be expecting any kind of major breakthroughs in Korea-Japan relations, right? And I think that would be a misreading probably of the domestic politics in South Korea, even though progressive foreign policy in South Korea is still changing. But apart from that, you know, a lot will depend on also how the regional situation develops with, you know, with North Korea in particular. And we could maybe talk about that when we talk about, you know, Yi's visit to Washington, because there was an interesting alignment between him and Trump, let's say, on North Korea diplomacy. That's going to be worth, I think, pulling on.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will get to that. I do want to turn to Yi's visit to the U.S., which, you know, interestingly, and the South Koreans have said that it wasn't necessary, but we don't have a joint statement really to work from, which I find curious. But there are sort of official statements and other sort of optical things we can draw from that all seemed very, very positive. You know, there were some clear priorities in the meeting, namely the economic realm. Shipbuilding in particular came up. He visited a shipyard, I think, in Philly right after the meeting. And, you know, so our listeners might recall, but in July, Seoul and Washington agreed on a trade deal to cut the reciprocal tariffs down to 15% for South Korea, and also lowering some of the Section 232 national security tariffs on automobiles, semiconductors, pharmaceuticals, that kind of stuff, also down to 15. And in return, South Korea agreed to invest an additional $350 billion in the United States and to purchase $100 billion in U.S. energy products through the end of Trump's administration. You know, Ankit, what movement did we see in these areas? Because these are big numbers, but, you know, what is the $350 billion in additional investment going to be in? And, you know, how do these economic and industrial issues, you know, factor into that geopolitical positioning for both the U.S. and South Korea?
Yeah. So, look, I actually think this is less about, you know, geopolitics in a way for Seoul. I mean, there is a geopolitical element to, you know, cooperating with the United States on shipbuilding. This has very much been a longstanding U.S. interest. But I think everything you just described, you know, the money going into the United States, the investment, all the talk about shipbuilding, centering that in the alliance, I think it's part of South Korea's Trump management plan, right? Every country around the world that values a friendly relationship with Washington, or an alliance with Washington, as Seoul does, is in the business of managing one man's ego. And, you know, there are some very clear things that Trump responds well to and other things he does not respond well to. And I think for Seoul, the biggest concern before this summit was to avoid some kind of public dressing down in the Oval Office, like, you know, Ukrainian President Zelensky's dressing down in February, or some kind of disastrous public relations moment like that. And I think happily, I think both sides were able to avoid that, right? I mean, some of the most contentious issues, which weren't really about, you know, how much money is Korea putting into the United States or shipbuilding, you know, that was more about the alliance. You know, Trump was asked about South Korea paying more money, which is contentious, but, you know, Lee Jae-myung did not take the bait or sort of, you know, contest that issue publicly. So the two leaders managed to get through the day without blowing anything up. And then there was the kind of curveball, as there often is with Trump, which was, I guess, the post that he released on Truth Social, where he, I think, asked, you know, what is going on in South Korea, and he compared it to a purge, I think alluding to the treatment of Yoon Suk-yeol, leader who tried to basically take over the country with a martial law declaration. And, you know, that raised some questions about whether the summit would be blown up, as Trump kind of decided to make this a central component, because he does seem to have a bit of an affinity for leaders like Yoon, like Bolsonaro in Brazil, who've been sort of, you might say, held accountable for the actions that they take while in office. And you know, God knows why he would be interested in that particular issue. But in any case, you know, I think that's the broader context through which I was kind of looking at this summit. And look, it's undeniable that I think all of that stuff is still happening. And there's a rich kind of tapestry of economic and security issues for the Korea-U.S. alliance to work on. But for this summit, it was really about, I think, the Korean progressives and specifically this new government showing that they could manage Trump. You know, that was one of the things that Moon Jae-in, you know, Lee Jae-myung's progressive predecessor during the first Trump administration, did very effectively, particularly when it came to the engagement with North Korea. So the big issues, I think, still remain unaddressed in terms of, you know, what does the alliance become? Does South Korea pay more? Do U.S. troops draw down from the peninsula? Does the alliance modernized to deal with competition with China in the Indo-Pacific? These issues were not hammered out, but you know, there will be a lot to do at the working level between the two countries as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we alluded to North Korea earlier, so let's finally turn to that. You know, in their meeting, both Lee and Trump seemed sort of game for a meeting with Kim Jong-un. What do you think about that possibility, and how does that fit into sort of ease desires with regard to the Korean Peninsula? And you know, a lot of things have changed since the last time Kim and Trump met. You know, we had an entire global pandemic. We had a lot of changes in both South Korea and the United States. And so, you know, I'm curious about where the possibility for that is. Listeners may want to go back to our previous episode about sort of Trump and his real summit fever. He likes to have bilateral summits. And so he likes to meet one-on-one with leaders, views himself as a deal maker. And that's sort of where, for him at least, deals are made. What do you make of the comments that were regarded North Korea during this meeting?
Yeah, so look, I mean, you know, both Lee Jae-myung and Trump came into that meeting in the Oval Office positively predisposed towards engaging North Korea. I will say for Lee Jae-myung, I mean, my reading of him is that, you know, he is a dyed-in-the-wool Korean progressive who values a different kind of peace-building approach towards North Korea. He's, you know, publicly stated that they will respect North Korea's regime, which is interesting because of the unification policy change in North Korea, which is arguably the most significant change in the inter-Korean context since the last bout of diplomacy in 2019. But the broader geopolitical conditions here for something changing, you know, we've talked about this on previous episodes this year. Trump wants to meet Kim. Kim doesn't want to meet Trump. And Kim lives in a completely different world. He's got, you know, Vladimir Putin, who is very happy to give him all kinds of goodies. North Korean soldiers just returned from Russia. Kim, you know, feted them in Pyongyang. It's very much a different geopolitical set of alignments from where Kim Jong-un is sitting. The big question mark for me is really about early next year, right? So the North Korean political calendar, they are wrapping up a five-year plan of military modernization. Mm-hmm. They're wrapping up the 8th Party Congress of the Workers' Party. They're going to head into the 9th Party Congress, which is you know, the apex political event on their calendar, which will probably take place in January. And it's possible there that Kim might indicate something different. The North Koreans have been very careful about not insulting Donald Trump. In fact, Kim's sister has pointed out that North Korea has a good relationship with Donald Trump. So, you know, never say never. Something could happen on the summit front. And if nothing else, the North Koreans are opportunistic and pragmatic. So they could meet Trump, but, you know, it might not be the kind of warmth or open-ended meeting that took place in Singapore, and hopefully not the disaster that took place in Hanoi when both leaders had mismatched expectations. But again, you know, on the Oval Office component, it was funny to watch Lee Jae-myung, you know, again, do the Trump management thing where he suggested that Trump could build a Trump Tower in North Korea, which is an idea that had previously, I think, been mostly a joke during the first bout of Trump-Kim diplomacy. But again, I think it showed that, you know, he was able to kind of build a rapport with Donald Trump, which is so interesting because, again, you know, when we talk about these summits and we talk about just like managing the United States today, we're not really talking about kind of like the alignment of national interests or policies. It's very much about how do you kind of, as a leader, show that you're willing to play ball with Donald Trump's ego. And I think Lee Jae-myung definitely came ready to do that on some level.
Yeah, fair enough. And one final thing I wanted to discuss because it came up as I was about to record this podcast. But, you know, interestingly to me, at least on August 27th, which is the day that we're recording, and Lee was on his way back to South Korea, Japan, the U.S., and Korea put out a joint statement on North Korean information technology workers. You know, what, which brought to my mind, you know, the question of that trilateral. We've discussed many times Donald Trump's preference for sort of bilateral engagements. But, you know, that trilateral seems to have survived the transition to a new administration. The Biden administration had put in a concerted effort to institutionalize it. So, you know, I'm curious, Ankit, about what you've seen. You know, how has the Trump administration approached that trilateral? And what should we be looking for in terms of effectiveness? You know, what is it that they're working on, and how is that working within, as you said, sort of an unusual time in terms of U.S. policymaking?
Yeah, so you know, this joint statement was interesting. I think the way I read it is kind of through, you know, my answer is gonna be a little boring because I think it's just gonna be about the bureaucratic politics of like how the sausage is made on North Korea policy. So yeah, you know, this has always been an area, well, not always, but, you know, even in the first Trump administration when there wasn't a lot of trilateral work, U.S., Japan, Korea collaboration on kind of North Korea sanctions implementation and advisories and kind of law enforcement, cyber espionage, that kind of stuff was still happening very much, you know, down in the trenches at the working level. And I think that has still persisted. It's very different from kind of what we saw under the Biden administration when you had sort of the spirit of Camp David after, you know, Yoon and Kishida went to Camp David with Biden. And that was very much like a comprehensive global trilateral relationship with, you know, intelligence sharing, military exercises, et cetera, et cetera. That stuff is nowhere to be seen. But, you know, nobody at the White House probably even knows that this joint statement came out. If they find out, they're probably not going to care. It's pretty inoffensive. They might care if Trump's trying to meet with Kim Jong-un, then maybe you don't bang the drum about North Korean IT workers. But apart from that, I think, you know, this is a good example of just how much institutionalized cooperation can still persist in a way, even if the entire political context of alliance relations has been turned on its head in a big way. So that's my reading of it. I think we've seen these kinds of trilateral statements also come out as the North Koreans launch, test missiles and do things that violate UN Security Council resolutions, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, one last thing, Katie, I just wanted to kind of point out is on North Korea, you know, the really interesting thing was that Trump did not mention denuclearization because obviously he doesn't care about denuclearization. But a lot of the Korean press, I think, is kind of fixated on that because there's been this anxiety that the United States might change its policy on North Korea. So that, too, I thought was an interesting moment. But, you know, before we close, I do kind of want to get your take on, you know, my reading of this whole thing as like a Trump management thing. I'm wondering if that resonated with you kind of watching the summit or if you think there was kind of, you know, more going on. I mean, obviously there was more going on, but I think that was still the primary frame through which I understood this.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would agree with that sort of view. And we can see this in not just the South Korea meeting, but, you know, every time that a world leader comes to the White House, it is pretty clear that they're managing Trump. And I think all of them have Zelensky's February meeting with Trump as sort of, you know, if everything is on a spectrum, that is the worst case scenario. You do not want to have that happen to you in the White House. And so how do you avoid that? Well, you can look at, honestly, how Zelensky handled his most recent meeting in the White House with Donald Trump. And so the change between those two is very much in tone, not necessarily in substance. And so there is clearly an approach that can be taken towards dealing with Donald Trump. Now, my question is always going to be, you know, what are the implications of that and what happens, you know, after you've had your nice White House meeting and everybody has gone home without sort of a PR incident? How does that then sort of go down into the policymaking, into the bureaucracy, which, you know, I don't know if we've covered it on this podcast as much, but there have been a lot of sort of hollowing out of parts of the State Department, parts of international development in particular. But yep, there's been a lot of sort of bureaucratic rejiggering and remanagement that I think will make some of this leap between leaders have agreed in a room to something to actually implementing policy decisions, because the people implementing those policy decisions also understand that Donald Trump has to be managed and he might change his mind. It's more difficult these days to effectively put in place policies based on the things the leader says, because the leader might change his mind tomorrow. And so there's only so much you can do within those bounds. And the human resources question is one that's beyond the scope of this podcast, but I think is certainly one interesting and ripe for exploring.
Yeah, no, I miss the days when our geopolitics podcast was less focused with the psychological tendencies of one particular person. But it's important today in geopolitics. You know, I mean, this is unfortunately a real issue. I mean, you know, I think I talked about this a bit on the last episode, but I was in Seoul and Tokyo in July, and you know, kind of the best case scenario for a lot of the kind of strategic experts, you know, not officials necessarily that I was speaking to, is like, you know, we just hope that we can muddle through these next kind of 3.5 years and not step on any major landmines with the United States, right? And I think from that vantage point, I think this U.S. Korea relation summit was very much a success. But then, you know, you're right. I mean, you know, like that post on Truth Social about a purge in South Korea, which appeared to really scare some South Korean officials. It's possible that just, you know, tomorrow or maybe before this podcast comes out, you know, Trump will see something on Fox News about Korean democracy or something and have a total meltdown. And then the U.S.-Korea relationship is in crisis management mode. So always, you know, I guess never a dull day in Washington these days. So
no, and we will always have more to talk about. I think that'll close us out for today. As always, thank you for listening. Wherever you get this podcast, please like, review it, get in touch with us with topic ideas. We'll be back with more soon. As always, thank you, Ankit.
Thanks, Katie. Always fun to do this.
All right.